In my final year at school, which was about 100 years ago, I had a fantastic economics teacher and who kind of put a whole spin on economics and how it actually worked in our society, not just as a theoretical study. And I recall he drew a Venn diagram on what was called a blackboard back then. I don't know if you ever heard of it. It had chalk and dusters. And in that Venn diagram, he showed the intersection of wealth in our country and worldwide against population. In those days, in the mid-1970s, 10% of the world's population owned 90% of the wealth. 10% of population, 90% of the wealth. Almost 50 years later, I still remember the unsettling feeling that I had of, well, that's just not fair. That unsettling feeling persists in me. And the reality is that wealth inequality has grown. This is a chart that was done by the Australian Institute showing from back in the 1950s here, right up to 2009 to 19, the distinction between the top 10% of ownership and the bottom 90%, which you can see back in the 50s, was quite different. And that continues to grow. This is based on a thing called the Gini index or the Gini coefficient, where the measure is taken per head of population as against the wealth and the income that they have. And so it's clear to see how wealth has become increasingly polarised into the few. The reason why wealth is increasingly concentrated on few, I think, are many and varied. The French economist Thomas Piketty claims that inheritance actually exacerbates the trend. So, for example, a financially successful person, even just moderately so, passes on wealth to the next generation, who are then able to grow more wealth and pass it on to the next generation. So it continues. So just there is this organic amassing of wealth from one generation to the other. Piketty argues that the way to combat this is for governments to redistribute generational wealth by means of an inheritance tax. You can imagine how popular that would be at the polls. But clearly, wealth distribution is a systemic problem arising from worldwide capitalist economics and market forces. As governments over time have abrogated responsibility, deregulated markets, so company ownership has shrunk, multinationals have abounded, and profits have been more and more polarised. To understand this, I think it's necessary to reflect on capitalism per se. George Monbiot argues that capitalism dates back to the 1450s. Excuse me. When the Portuguese invaded and colonised Madeira off the coast of Morocco, a tiny island. He claims there were three contributing elements: land acquisition, labour, in that case in the form of slavery, and indeed the money and capital that they already had behind them. By occupying the land and commoditising its natural resources, they then used the locals as slave labour to harvest timber, all backed by their already inconsiderable wealth. Of course, once the resources were depleted, they quit the island as a commercial venture. Thus, Monbiot maintains that capitalism has actually been founded, even way back then, on colonial looting. In some sense, I find this analysis a little oversimplified, given that there are probably many other factors at play, not least is the Industrial Revolution, beginning in the late 1700s in England. What is evident, though, is that production and ownership have become separated. Let's just have a look at the characteristics of capitalism. It's characterised, of course, by private ownership of the means of production, where labour is solely paid wages. And so to break down the key aspects of that, private ownership. In capitalism, individuals or corporations own and control most of the factors of production, such as land, factories, and machinery. Then leads to a profit motive. The primary goal, in fact, in some senses the only goal, is to generate profit. Businesses aim to maximise their earnings through efficient production and sales. This leads to a market economy where decision-making and investment are determined by the wealthy owners, while prices and the distribution of goods and services are only influenced by competition within markets. Wage labour. Workers are employed by businesses and receive wages for their labour. Their work contributes to the production process. Property rights. Capitalism relies on enforcing private property rights, which incentivise investment and productive use of capital. So, what's the impact of capitalism on society? I'd argue that profit becomes the key motivation in all production. Profit goes to the ever more selective few, that is, owners and shareholders. The market, that is, supply and demand, are the drivers of production. Wage labour becomes another means of production, just like raw materials. And profit, property and the means of production, ownership, are increasingly polarised. So what's happened is that people who work now have suddenly become part of the means of production. And I would argue, and here's the kicker, that capitalism actually destroys social cohesion. The whole system of capitalism has a tendency to be adversarial. Not only is there competition in the marketplace, hence competitors become an obstacle, but the worker, being tied to set wages, is always competing. Competing against the profit margin awarded to owners and shareholders. Hence, any desire for increased wages comes at the cost of profit. There's also a psychological impact where the worker is disenfranchised from the end of the product, disincentivising workers. The job market itself becomes a competition, whereas Jean-Paul Sartre's terms, we turn the other person into an object that impedes my growth, my opportunities. The other becomes someone who impedes my aspirations. Since the 1970s and the advent of neoliberalism against a backdrop of the collapse of Keynesian economics, and that basically is governments withdrawing any intervention in macroeconomics, capitalism has gained a foothold in almost every aspect of our lives. Everything becomes an asset, such as a family home, the media, and every aspect of society now is succumbed to the marketplace. Given the competitive nature of the market and ubiquitous drive for profits, along with alienation from goods and services, it led Margaret Thatcher in 1987 to declare there is now no such thing as society. Meaning, don't look to government, it's every man, woman, for himself or herself. So the individual has actually been atomised and disenfranchised. And it seems to me that can only lead to kind of a class warfare, where you have the worker and you have those who control the means of production and profit. Against themselves, striving for continual growth. Nowadays, a rise in GDP becomes the hallmark of good governments. Just as an aside, now politics itself has alighted into the market as well. Election promises, we notice, are always appeals now for votes based on how much money or in kind that I will get if I vote for a particular party. So clearly we've lost any sense of the common good. The measurement of GDP as an indicator of a nation's progress is, to my mind, problematic on a number of fronts. The elements that are mentioned and that are then measured are not necessarily things that are good for our country. Further, when broken down to per capita, it doesn't represent any equal distribution. So on the left, you see these are the elements that are taken into our GDP. And these show the figures in millions of dollars of what they represent. And so the government comes out and says proudly, oh, we've had a 1.5% growth in GDP. Isn't our economy going wonderfully? Also, is constant growth actually desirable? Calculations include the elements that have a negative impact on our environment. For example, coal mining is included in GDP. Well-being, such as public administration, spent on things like armament, incarceration, protection against refugees, all those things also become centres of what helps raise the GDP. In an attempt to combat this, the New Economics Foundation introduced what they've called the Happy Planet Index. This follows a guy named Amartya Sen. He's an economist in India and has always tried to build welfare into his economic assessments. He sees it's an inadequate instrument and that the general goal of human being is to be happy over a long life expectancy. The Happy Planet Index, therefore, introduces things from an ecological footprint. Health, longevity of life, next to wealth accumulation. Interestingly, at the moment in Australia, both the federal and state governments are currently looking at well-being indices to build into their economic rationalisation and assessments. But the obvious problem of this to me is twofold. First, happiness is very subjective. And there's no real metrics for measuring well-being. How do you feel today out of 10? Bit hard to work out, let alone on a national scale. So I'd like to introduce you to one possible way of thinking about the economy and the limitations around growth and economic rationalism. It comes from Kate Raworth's book, The Donut Economy, and it seeks to develop a framework for sustainable development. Interestingly, just after I read this book, it also was mentioned in Pope Francis's book, Dare to Dream, so it must be right. while she doesn't do this, I think it's easier to understand if we begin by thinking of an individual family. What do I want out of life? What is the end to which I work? I think it's safe to say that all of us work to provide financially for the basics of life. Food, a home, clothing, healthcare, transport, education for our children, saving for retirement and recreation. They seem to me to be the core kind of values that we want in our family lives. You might think of others. I therefore ensure that I, or at least our household, can generate an income which provides for those necessities. But what if I want more? Overseas holidays, a flash car, swimming pool, or other non-essential items. Notice I didn't use the term luxury items, but non-essential, and I think there's a distinction. To pay for them, I have choices. I might decide to increase my income by working longer hours, taking on a second job, or maybe taking on part-time study so that I can gain more skills and get a better job, get promoted. There comes a point, however, where extra work commitment can begin to have a deleterious effect, because it takes time away from the family, can damage relationships, increased workload can put a strain on health, both mental and physical, and a range of other harmful effects. It's interesting that one of the highest incidents of breakdown in family life is in people who are working away from home and working long hours. For example, the people who are working in that fly-in, fly-out mining jobs. Huge marriage and family breakdowns. It's ironic, isn't it, that the thing that often people work so hard for, the love of their family, is what actually is destroyed by the extra commitments and time that they take on. And I actually worked in a sector of this for a little while, where I was working for what's now Telstra, and we were working in the country, and we were paid big money to work away from our home base in Sydney. But of all of those around me, I was single and young, it was fine for me, I just earned a lot of money. But for them, they're away from their families, and there's a huge divorce rate amongst those people. And they were doing it to try and get more money for their families. Okay, so let's now move to the donut economy as it applies to the national and indeed international stage. Raworth uses a diagram to elucidate her point, and the visual will show you where the name comes from. This inner circle here identifies the aspects of communal life necessary for human flourishing. So, the things that we as a nation and indeed as a world think are most important: water, food, health, education, income, peace and justice, political voice, gender equality, social equality, equity, housing, networks and energy. They are considered by her to be the core things that we cannot do without. Outside of that circle is the things that are the cost that we can experience in an income, in our over expenditure, climate change and all the things that go with it, ocean acidification, pollution, nitrogen and phosphorus loading, freshwater withdrawals, land convention, biodiversity, all of those things that we are experiencing in the climate change and degradation of our planet. So, she argues, that between the shortfall down here, if we don't have sufficient income, we can't provide these things, and this overshoot, that is spending too much using these resources, is the sweet spot, what she calls the donut, the Goldilocks zone, if you like. Raworth argues that we do not need continual growth in our economy, since when this moves beyond the donut, it has that negative impact on the environment. Equally, we cannot let income production fall below the level required to sustain the social foundation of society. So you get the idea that this is the kind of safe zone. There's not ongoing capital growth, there's not ongoing growth in GDP, but it's having an income and a gross domestic product that sits here able to provide for the necessities of life as a nation without going beyond and damaging the environment. Kate Raworth's donut economy is only really one example of contemporary economics challenging the need for continual growth in GDP. One of the things that all of these share in common is the need for a broader cross-section of society to have a voice in decision-making and to avoid what Robert Reich calls the oligarchy ruling US politics. Reich argues that in the United States, and I think it's probably true in Australia too, that there are a limited number of very, very wealthy people who have all the influence over government policy. If you'd like an example from the US, the National Rifle Association holds an enormous sway over politics there. And we think in Australia, perhaps of mining companies and indeed media, how they are such big donors to government that government's frightened to offend them by policies that they might implement. Think how hard it is, however, to rein in social media platforms. In Australia too, the gambling industry, which most of us would think is overreached these days, is one of those aspects that government needs to rein in, but of course they get huge income out of it as well in terms of taxation. Worldwide and throughout history, it has been grassroots movements really that have challenged government policy, bottom-up politics if you like, that's initiated real change. We can think, for example, of South Africa and the apartheid movements, in UK, labour movements, and so on throughout the world. Yet in modern times, I think consensus seems increasingly unattainable, because I think that in most Western nations now, we have a climate of self-interest around challenging wealth. So when a budget gets handed down, we say, you beaut, I'm going to get an extra $300 off my electricity bill. So is everybody else, no matter how wealthy they might be. So there's a sense in which to think about a just economy, we need to reflect on what it means for that to exist. To do that, I just wanted to go back very quickly and highlight again the church's teaching over time on justice, the principles of the church's social teaching. I'm sure you yourselves can look at this list and think, how is that actually happening in our society as a whole? How are we caring for common good, the universal destination of goods, principle of subsidiarity, things being done at the local level, participation, that has dwindled so much as time goes by. Solidarity, does that exist in our society at all? Solidarity with the poor and the needy? I'm talking in terms of policy, not what you wonderful people are doing in your own lives. And the fundamental values of social life. Social life just seems to be eroding more and more. Privatisation has taken over. Think of entertainment. Do people go to the movies anymore, or do they stay home and stream it on Netflix? Do we go out to restaurants, or do we order Uber? Do we have a society? And we look at the groups in society that are breaking down now, everything from the Scouts movement to participation in church groups. And, of course, the way of love. Are these loving things to do? See how many you can tick off for our capitalist system. Just finally, the themes of Catholic social teaching. The just economy is founded on these principles, not the principles of profit where workers are displaced. The human person and human flourishing in community should be the central tenet of government policy and economic management. In 1987, the film Wall Street, that Michael Douglas character Gordon Gekko famously proclaimed, "Greed is good," and many people felt better about themselves.